John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for knots, oh no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQTRadio@hushmail.com, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Centre, www.imemc.org, for Monday, January the 3rd, 2011. Today it is reported that the Asia One Solidarity Convoy managed to enter the Gaza Strip on Sunday night, after arriving at the Egyptian port of Al Arish. The Egyptian authorities allowed 112 activists to enter Gaza, but one Iranian and one Jordanian activists were denied entry. Convoy organisers were warmly received by thousands of residents in the Strip. Also today, 48 Knesset members signed a petition calling for the boycott of Israeli companies involved in the building of the new Palestinian city of Rawabi, as they have agreed not to use any products or services from illegal settlements during the construction. Amongst the signatories are all the right-wing MKs, as well as half of the Kadima faction. According to Haaretz, the petition has been put forward by the Eretz Yisrael lobby. In other news, Hamas spokesman Fawzi Bahoum claimed that in 2010, 3,000 Hamas affiliates were arrested by the PA security forces in the West Bank. Amongst the detainees are imams, university students, professors, journalists and businessmen. Bahoum also added that the Fatah-led government ignores calls for an end to political arrests and for the promotion of national unity. With regard to the killings of two Palestinians by the Israeli army within 48 hours, the UN has expressed its concern and is awaiting the full facts of these tragic fatalities, Mar News reported. The victims of the Israeli military attacks were Jahaba Abu Rama, 35, who died on Saturday after inhaling tear gas fired by Israeli soldiers at the anti-wall rally in Bilin on Friday, and Mahmoud Mohammed Daragmi, 21, who was fatally shot by soldiers at Al-Hamra checkpoint east of Nablus on Sunday. Meanwhile, the Palestinian Authority spokesman Nabil Abu Rudaina considered the killings to be a dangerous escalation by Israel and added that the attacks do not give any hope for the peace process. In related news, the Israeli army bombarded northern and central Gaza on Sunday at dawn, wounding two residents and damaging several homes. The first attack targeted a site believed to be used as a training centre for the Al-Qassam Brigades, the armed wing of Hamas. The second attack targeted the west area of Al-Nuzairat refugee camp. In separate reports, the Israeli Ministerial Council decided on Sunday to extend the ban on family reunification for Palestinians married to Israelis for an additional 6 months. According to the law, Palestinians married to Israeli spouses will not be granted residency, and Arab-Palestinian spouses will not be allowed to live in Jerusalem or Israel. The cabinet claims that this issue is directly related to Israel's security interests. That sums up our news for today. Thank you for joining us from Occupy Bethlehem. You've been listening to Palestine Today from International Middle East Media Centre. For more updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. This report has been brought to you by Hassan Cassis and Colin Bell.
Human Rights Watch has just released a report titled Separate and Unequal, Israel's Discriminatory Treatment of Palestinians in the Occupied Palestinian Territories, which documents specific and egregious discrimination against Palestinian residents of Area C of the West Bank, which is an area exclusively controlled by Israel, not the Palestinian Authority. Material for the report was collected through interviews with Palestinians in several villages, with Israeli settlers in the West Bank, and from two leaked Israeli government reports documenting conditions in both the settlements, which are considered illegal under international law, and settlement outposts, which are considered illegal even by Israel. Among other things, the report documents the scarcity of water in Palestinian communities, while nearby settlements have swimming pools, and Palestinian children studying by candlelight, as nearby Israeli settlements light up the night with electricity from the grid. Between the lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Bill Van Esveld, a Middle East researcher with Human Rights Watch based in Jerusalem, and the author of the Separate and Unequal report. Speaking by phone from Israel, he describes the conditions investigated and explains some of Human Rights Watch proposals for easing discrimination.
What we found was pretty striking. In one case, in the northern Jordan Valley, which is up in the northeastern part of the West Bank, there's a Palestinian village that used to be a farming community. And when Israel occupied the area, drilled some wells and set up some civilian settlements that are mostly agricultural. And the new wells drilled by Israel to service those agricultural settlements basically dried out the Palestinian wells. Now, the Palestinians have lost about half of the amount of agricultural land that they used to be able to cultivate, while the Israeli settlements, you know, there's a swimming pool in one of them that also operates a little guest house for tourists, and they're exporting a lot of agricultural crops to European and other markets. Meanwhile, Palestinians are actually going into debt or into poverty, and in some cases have basically had to move out of that town to other areas of the West Bank in hopes of just being able to make a living.
Is that part of the intent, to remove Palestinians from more land in the West Bank?
Well, we don't have any sort of smoking gun document that would demonstrate an Israeli intent to empty out Area C of Palestinians. There's not evidence to back up such a claim. What there is evidence of is the fact that just Palestinians are leaving. In many cases, they have left communities in Area C because they told us it's just impossible to continue living there. Many of them are not connected to the water network, or if they are connected, they turn on their tap and it's often nothing comes out. In light of that, they have to buy water in water tankers that are driven along roads behind tractors. Even the water tankers can be confiscated if they're not properly permitted. So people have effectively been forced to leave their homes.
And one of the rationales that Israelis use for continuing to build settlements is to allow for what they call natural increase. That is, to allow families to expand their homes as their families expand, right?
Right. Well, this is an irony. There actually is a building freeze going on in the West Bank right now, but it's not being imposed against settlers. It's being imposed against Palestinians living in Area C. And it's so severe that, in fact, there is no natural growth being allowed in Palestinian communities. That's the sort of discrimination that we've found, and it spans a lot of areas of everyday life that don't seem to have any rational benefit to Israeli security or even the welfare of settlers living nearby. It seems unnecessarily harsh and punitive.
Bill Van Esveld, Human Rights Watch has noted Israel's legitimate security concerns, and Israel justifies these restrictions in the West Bank on that basis. Isn't that right?
We take that into account, but no security argument can conceivably explain refusing to allow somebody to build a water tank or a house or a medical clinic or a school. There's just to claim that that's a security concern seems absurd. In other cases, there is a security argument, such as preventing people from moving on roads or erecting roadblocks or checkpoints. But those security limitations and freedom of movement limitations have been imposed in a really blanket fashion that basically target all Palestinians moving on those roads as if they were all security threats. Old women, old men, you know, babies, a lot of them. And that is just treating an entire population as if every one of them is a security threat based on nothing but their ethnicity or national origin. And you can limit people's freedom of movement, but you have to do so on a tailored and specific basis. You can't just say that everybody who happens to look a certain way is a security threat and therefore we can prevent them from moving around. Meanwhile, of course, settlers have special bypass roads that are built for them, while Palestinians are prevented from paving their roads and have to navigate numerous roadblocks and checkpoints.
Your report says, quote, donor countries must avoid complicity in violations of international law caused by the settlements. In other words, where settlements are draining resources, and it says the European Union should identify cases where discrimination against Palestinians contributed to the production of goods that are then sent to the EU and other places. It seems like that would cover all goods produced in the settlements.
Well, it could. Basically, we made that recommendation because we only examined in detail a few specific cases. So we don't have the facts to make an argument that all businesses that are taking part in settlements are in some way directly themselves contributing to discrimination against Palestinians. But what we're saying is that there's a lot of evidence out there that that might be the case, and that businesses often claim to have their own human rights or ethical standards. The United Nations has put out a framework for how businesses should behave to take human rights concerns into account. So what we're saying is that businesses need to be on notice. If you're a business and you have activities in settlements, you need to be on notice that there's a lot of severe discrimination going on there, and you need to carefully and independently review your activities to make sure that you're not complicit in it. And if you are, you have to take the appropriate steps to mitigate and prevent that contribution to violations of human rights. And if necessary, if the only way to do that is to stop your operations there, then you need to do so.
What has been the Israeli response to your report?
We've had informal meetings with a number of Israeli officials who were, to my pleasant surprise, quite supportive of the report's findings and concerned by them. But, you know, those people were not in the Prime Minister's office. The official response has been quite harsh. Unfortunately, that's fairly predictable. But we hope that the Israeli government will see this report as constructive criticism. The report is basically calling on Israel to, of course, abide by its obligations under the Geneva Conventions to withdraw its settlers and dismantle the settlements. But that may take a while, but what it could immediately and should immediately do is stop discriminatory policies that are harming Palestinians.
That was Bill Van Esveld, a Middle East researcher with Human Rights Watch based in Jerusalem and author of the Separate and Unequal Report. To read the report online, visit the group's website at hrw.org or call Human Rights Watch at area code 212-290-4700.
Iraq, Sunday. CNN is reporting the deaths of two U.S. service members in an undisclosed incident. Afghanistan, Saturday. The British military is reporting the death of a British occupation soldier from a roadside bombing in the Nari Siraj district, Helmand Province, Afghanistan. Afghanistan, Sunday. NATO is reporting the death of an occupation soldier from an IED attack in an undisclosed location in southern Afghanistan. Afghanistan, ongoing. Mawan Safi for the Institute for War and Peace Reporting is reporting that some Afghan security personnel are deserting because they fear a Taliban victory in the event of a U.S. withdrawal. Pakistan, yesterday, another NATO oil tanker was blown up and burned in the Khyber Pass. Baghdad, Iraq, Sunday. Unknown gunmen stormed the house of a prosecutor in a town north of Baghdad using bombs and explosive charges that badly injured the prosecutor. The attack also killed the prosecutor's son and wounded 8 family members, according to police. Balad, Iraq, yesterday. A judge's house was bombed in a town outside Balad, according to police. Hardin Khalaf, a chief judge, was wounded along with 8 members of his family. His nephew was killed. Diyala Province, Iraq, yesterday, a suicide car bomber attacked an office of the Iraqi intelligence services in a city northeast of Baghdad, wounding 28 people according to official reports. Baghdad, Sunday night, gunmen swept through the city, assassinating 6 security officials as well as a number of other government employees. Mr. Barack Obama, does this sound like 8 years of war and occupation have done anything to make Iraq governable? Does this sound like Afghanistan is going to turn out any different? Now's the time to cut your losses and throw in the towel. Bring all the troops home today.
And no amount of money you could give me, honey, couldn't pay me, ain't going back again. I ain't going back again. I ain't going back again. You won't see me back there again. No, you won't see me back there again.
Suppose Army recruiting ads had to have side effect warnings like drug advertisements on TV do.
The United States Army may not be right for every patient. Side effects can include distress, disillusionment, bitter resentment, isolation, traumatic and post-traumatic stress, sociopathic behavior, uncontrollable sobbing, uncontrollable violence, prosecutions for war crimes, prosecutions for domestic crimes, loss of contact with loved ones, loss of ability to love, brain injuries, blindness, depleted uranium poisoning, flashbacks, horror of death, horror of being away from death, loss of the use of limbs, loss of limbs, death, suicide, excruciating pain, the desire to feel excruciating pain, overwhelming rage and misery, loss of hearing, punishment by the Army for failure to obey illegal orders, punishment by courts of law or by enemy forces for obeying illegal orders, torture, humiliation, shame, dangerous habits of blind subservience, or the wasting of what could have been the best years of your life. If you experience any of these symptoms, deal with it, sucker. You already signed your name on the dotted line.
The investigative news agency ProPublica reports that the Obama White House is preparing a new executive order on indefinite detention, which will allow regular reviews of evidence for dozens of prisoners held at the U.S. prison camp in Guantanamo Bay. The executive order has been in the works for nearly 18 months, and it will help define the Obama administration's long-term policy toward high-value detainees, including those held indefinitely without trial. Nearly 2 years ago, President Obama promised to close the Guantanamo detention facility, but has faced stiff resistance from Congress, as well as deteriorating political conditions in Yemen and other home countries of detainees. Currently, 48 prisoners are held under indefinite detention. The number is expected to increase in coming months due to administrative transfers. The draft executive order would give these detainees a review every 6 months and a more comprehensive annual review. In 2008, Guantanamo detainees won the right to challenge the lawfulness of their detention in court, which is separate from the new White House executive order that would examine the necessity of extended detention. Jamil Jaffer of the American Civil Liberties Union noted the draft order was an improvement over the current situation, but he warned that the order would normalize and institutionalize indefinite detention and other anti-terror policies devised by the Bush administration, presenting a profound threat to human rights and the rule of law.
Just another young soldier caught up in a power game. Will you show me that I can die in the moon? Remember me when the blood starts flowing. Remember me when the truth gets pushed down. Remember me when the problem starts growing. Remember me and please don't let me go.
Speaking of the truth getting pushed around,
and
from the bloody streets of Baghdad on the hills of Kandahar, a lot of good folks are trapped through the grip of war, and the only thing that's changing are the names on the graves. Will you show me that I can cry? Remember me when the blood starts. Remember me when the prophet starts growing. Remember me and please don't let me down.
This goes out to everybody from Iraq that has been supporting. From the crowd, any Vietnam vets, Vietnam era vets, friends, supporters, sisters, any of y'all.
So now I'm saying what so many soldiers said before. If you care about the soldier, then stand against the war. Don't let these occupations continue in our name. And show me that I didn't die in vain. Remember me when the blood starts flowing. Remember me when the truth gets pushed around. Remember me when the prophet starts growing.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQTRadio@hushmail.com, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
On the 3rd of January, barely after New Year's Day, the Metro Riders Advisory Council held a public meeting, the main subject on the agenda being the bag searches, where a lot of people showed up to tell Metro, don't touch my junk.
People coming in for the hearing. Get a load of this. Bag searches at a public meeting on bag searches.
You want to search my bags to attend a public meeting about bag searches? Metro, don't touch my junk! What a brilliant way to keep people from speaking out about bag searches. Bag searches to get into the meeting. Anyway, here's what someone had to say outside the hearing.
Yeah, and I believe that, people gotta stand up for their civil rights. And, security's important, but, so is civil rights.
Yeah. Well, I couldn't get in there. I had just one thing to say to him. Don't touch my junk.
I hear you.
Some folks who did get into the hearing said they were going to boycott Metro over the bag searches. One man was quoted in the Washington Post as saying if the cops demanded to search his bag, he would refuse to search and boycott Metro for the next 5 trips. Here's what somebody inside the hearing had to say as recorded by another radio station.
Metro System is thus going to great expense to drive down its own ridership.
Worried about the terrorists winning every time somebody is searched for no reason, the terrorists win again.
That's right, Metro. And you have no right to sacrifice our civil liberties on the altar of security voodoo. What are you doing, Metro? Trying to sell cars?
By a 3-2 vote on December 21st, the Federal Communications Commission approved what they labeled as new net neutrality rules they assert are intended to prevent giant telecommunications companies like AT&T and Verizon from acting as powerful internet gatekeepers. The media reform group Free Press strongly criticized the rules, stating that they're riddled with loopholes which benefit the nation's largest telecommunication corporations. The group further complained that the rules do little to prevent phone and cable companies from segregating the internet into a superhighway with fast access for some and slow lanes for others, determined by the size of content providers' wallets. Free Press also objected to the rules' inherent discrimination against wireless users and the weak rules applied to wired networks. A coalition of free internet activist groups have expressed disappointment with the FCC vote and accused President Obama of betraying his 2008 campaign pledge to preserve an open internet and protect consumers. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Joe Torres, senior advisor for government relations and external affairs with the media reform group Free Press. He takes a critical look at the FCC's new rules and describes the enormous influence of the telecommunications companies that lobbied hard to obstruct all real effective net neutrality rules.
So we're calling it fake net neutrality because even though the chairman is trying to claim victory and say that he fulfilled President Obama's campaign promise, he'll take a backseat to no one in his support for net neutrality, what the chairman actually voted on is that the whole fight over net neutrality is trying to prevent these companies from discriminating online. And what we mean by discriminating online means they have the ability to slow up or speed up web traffic, whether it's your website or an application. And if they're able to do that, they can create these economic barriers that would prevent the smaller guy from competing. What may happen now is that if you want your website to be seen by the public at the fastest speeds, you're going to have to pay more to make sure the public can access your site at the fastest speed. But meanwhile, you're also competing against companies that have deeper pockets who can pay to make sure their sites are sped up. So those who can't afford to have their site sped up will be slowed down. And that would fundamentally change the way the Internet has always worked. The Internet has always worked in a way in which the ISPs had to treat all web traffic equally. And what the FCC voted on basically has destroyed that framework that's always existed. So on wireless, it's even worse. So on wireless is actually everything I just described, but also these companies have the ability to block applications and websites on wireless as well. So it goes even further on wireless on the harms they can cause.
What do you think caused the FCC and the chairman to backtrack so fundamentally on the pledge by Obama and this FCC themselves to bolster net neutrality as opposed to blowing all these loopholes through it?
It's the power of these corporations. It's the power of AT&T, Verizon, and Comcast. These companies are amongst the most powerful corporations in D.C. lobbying. Literally last year we found that close to $100 million was spent by the telecom industry with over 500 lobbyists, and they have deep pockets. They employ former members of Congress and former Democratic FCC staff members. You had, over this past year, you had close to 80 Democrats calling on the FCC not to pass net neutrality. So you had all the Republicans and about 80 Democrats telling the FCC not to move forward with this. You had all that political pressure from within his own party. And that's because of the power of the telecom companies able to work the Hill and get support from the Hill against the FCC. So over the course of the year, they slowly wore this chairman down. And this chairman, instead of acting as an independent regulator, he was more concerned about how the political winds in Congress. And so this is how we got here.
Joe, what are the next steps here? I've heard that with last year's D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals ruling, that the FCC overstepped its authority to regulate the internet, that this set of flawed, loophole-ridden net neutrality rules could be in jeopardy. Is that something that is a silver lining here, that this rule may not go into effect? Or what are the options that groups like yours have and the public at large to push for really a true net neutrality rules?
The FCC actually published its order late last week before everyone went away for Christmas. So we're looking through the fine print. Hopefully there's good transparency rules in there that will allow us to document the abuses and the harm that's being caused by these rules. But the legality of this is a great question, because what the courts found earlier this year was that the legal foundation that was established during the Bush administration, during the Bush years, the FCC deregulated the broadband industry. It moved broadband from what's called a Title II service to a Title I. That was it was a deregulatory move to make sure these companies didn't have competitors. The courts found that the framework in which the FCC was regulating broadband under this Title I distinction, which the Bush administration established, was not legal. So the FCC had the choice, this chairman, Julius Genachowski, had a decision that he can re-regulate the industry by moving broadband back into a Title II service. He chose not to pass these network neutrality rules under a more sound legal footing. And so what's going to happen is going to go back to court, and the likelihood that this is going to get knocked down is great. While that may seem like a silver lining, here you have President Obama, who's seen as a network neutrality champion, put in his mark on what he says net neutrality is. And now, if these rules are not stayed, you're going to have all sorts of bad practices beginning to happen. And it's always difficult to put the genie back in the bottle to fight that, you know, but this is what we have to do. We're going to make the case in court. Hopefully, if there's a court case, I don't know if we're going to pursue or not. We're thinking about that. But there's still a lot of fight left to be had.
That was Joe Torres, Senior Advisor for Government Relations and External Affairs with the media reform group Free Press. Contact Free Press toll-free at 877-888-1533 or visit their SaveTheInternet.com website.
Ever wonder why we have to have things like pirate radio that not only can't be controlled by the FCC, but can't be controlled by Comcast and Verizon either? Like the next season of Whale Wars is now playing live in the Southern Ocean. Sea Shepherd has caught Japan's illegal whaling fleet before they were able to kill a single whale. New Year's Eve, about 9 a.m. Australian time, the Sea Shepherd ship Bob Barker found a harpoon ship on the edge of the ice. The harpoon ship tried to run and lure the Bob Barker away from the whaling factory ship Nishan Maru. About 6 hours later, another Sea Shepherd ship found a harpoon ship, Yushin Maru number 2, about 60 miles away, while the helicopter and the fast ship Gojira searched for the factory ship. The whalers had claimed they would hunt elsewhere and over a larger area to make themselves harder to find, but they had to go where the whales go to catch any, so Sea Shepherd called their bluff and was ready and waiting when Japan's whale poachers showed up in their usual area. The whalers were nearly a month late to leave port and did not manage to kill a single whale prior to being caught by Sea Shepherd. With all three Sea Shepherd ships on their tail, they might not be able to kill a single whale all year. There is no way all three Sea Shepherd ships will ever run out of fuel all at once. There is no ship in the whalers' fleet that can catch or escape the super ship Gojira. Gojira means Godzilla in Japanese, and this ship is a replacement for the Otigil, sunk last year by the whaler's security ship Shonen Maru number 2, after being rammed like PT-109. Now a WikiLeaks cable has a deputy general director of the Japanese fishing agency, Yamashita, whining that, quote, harassment of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society has kept the Japanese whaling fleet from reaching its quotas these past few years. Damned right, and may this year's harassment prove the most effective of all. Hopefully Japan won't be able to kill a single whale this year.
Activists have been battling mountaintop removal coal mining in Appalachia for many years, and some now have turned their attention to fighting the ravages of natural gas drilling. West Virginia ranks third among states, behind Texas and Pennsylvania, in the number of gas wells, now totaling 48,000. More recently, horizontal gas drilling in the Marcellus Shale Formation has created even more severe scars on the land, and the resulting pollution has threatened drinking water in several states. New York's Governor David Patterson recently imposed a six-month moratorium on certain kinds of gas drilling in the Marcellus Shale, which extends mostly across parts of New York and Pennsylvania and almost all of West Virginia. Hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, is a gas drilling method in which millions of gallons of water, a secret mix of toxic chemicals and sand, are injected into wells to break apart shale and release trapped gas. The drilling method has polluted groundwater, created contaminated industrial sites in some rural areas, and caused illnesses, according to people who live near fracking operations. Between the lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Cindy Rank, a leader of the West Virginia Highlands Conservancy, who has been active in opposing mountaintop removal mining around her home in northern West Virginia, which is now where the bulk of gas drilling in the Marcellus Shale is taking place. Here, she talks about the two issues and recent efforts to better regulate the growing number of natural gas wells.
Many people talk about mountaintop removal being strip mining on steroids, and this new gas drilling is just that. I mean, it's gas drilling on steroids, as far as I'm concerned. So that all of the problems that we encountered back in 1980 through the early 80s throughout our area, in addition to the mining that we were fighting, was a lot of the gas drilling, the conventional gas drilling. Most of it was less than 6,000 feet deep. Most of it was more 4,000 feet, whatever. But the footprint and the truck traffic and the impact of pipelines and compressor stations, all of that has increased 100-fold when you get to these bigger Marcellus sites. The impact on the communities and on the earth and on the roads and even in the air, although that's gotten less attention to this point, although I think it's going to be increasing as people have looked at all these different aspects of the drilling. You know, it's just a larger impact all around, whether you're talking about the air or the actual on-the-ground footprint.
Cindy Rank, is the main distinction in drilling in the Marcellus Shale that it's horizontal drilling, or does that go on in other kinds of gas drilling as well?
Well, one, you can do vertical drilling into Marcellus as well as horizontal. When you go down vertical and send out your lateral or your horizontal leg, which you then frack out 3,000, maybe more or less, feet, you're getting that much more gas coming up through the well site. So vertical drilling is done into the Marcellus, but it seems to be more efficient to do horizontal drilling.
A lot of people in industry and, you know, even environmentalists point out that natural gas is the cleanest fossil fuel and coal is by far the dirtiest. So natural gas must be the bridge fuel to get us off fossil fuels to clean, renewable energy. So, hallelujah.
I can't do hallelujah for this gas. I mean, one of the problems with coal is, you know, the whole life cycle of whatever it is you're talking about is what's important. Visually, there is nothing to compare to mountaintop removal. And it's horrendous and wipes out communities, whole communities. Visually, you're not going to get the same effect, I don't think, from all of this gas drilling. But the individuals like Endemic PA and all of those other places where, strangely enough, their water is impacted, whether or not it's directly a factor of the fracturing or whether the fracturing triggers something else that's already, you know, cracked or not the greatest and allows methane to get up into their wells. I really do believe that there's going to be a very large impact on water, maybe not the same kind as the selenium and everything else we're getting out of the mountaintop removal sites, but I think some of the groundwater resources that many of us depend on for wells and springs, et cetera, may well be impacted by this new gas drilling, but the footprint and the disturbance in the communities, you know, that has to be taken into account. Plus, there are studies that are coming out now that the emissions from these things in terms of greenhouse gas and methane are not as friendly as people would hope that they were. And I guess it's a problem if you're talking about degree of acceptance of fossil fuels. You're already talking kind of devilish choices. It's like, why fossil fuels in the first place, you know? Because when you're talking about fossil fuels, you're talking about finite resources that are really not friendly to extract and to burn. We're finding out that the gas burning isn't as nearly as friendly as we had all hoped. Now, whether or not that makes it a viable bridge option, whether or not it's worth the risk to all of the water resources throughout these areas in the future, you know, I don't know. It's just one of those things I think that we're unprepared for.
That was Cindy Rank of the West Virginia Highlands Conservancy. For more information on both mountaintop removal mining and gas drilling in West Virginia, Visit the group's website at wvhighlands.org.